Thank you, Ray. Good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate your forbearance as I was not participating in the singing. There were two more slides I wanted to do, one of which I got mostly done in the car and the other I didn't. You're not going to be able to read them, but you need to see some. There's a design in there. I think we're going to get that far. Don't know for sure. It's one of these sermons that's going to take more than one time, and we'll see how far we get today. I'd like you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, or maybe it's chapter 1, I don't even remember now. It's 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1, starting in verse 1, if you would. And Paul's writing to the Corinthians, and he says that when he first came to them, he didn't come with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you other than or save Jesus Christ and him crucified. Then verse 3 says, and I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. Now, if you're like me, you just read over that and you don't think he's just saying what his attitude was and so forth. But if you if you pause there and think about it, you may have a question. Like, well, why was he weak and in fear and had much trembling? What was going on? What had happened to him, or what had he experienced that may give us an indication of why he had that approach? Well, I'd like to begin the sermon by asking that question and proposing an answer. If you would, we're going to be back in Corinthians, but in the meantime, we're going to go to Acts. So I'm going to try to mark it here so it doesn't take me so long to find it. Go back to the book of Acts. Now, you remember in Acts chapter 15, they had the meeting, you know, where the directive was given to the Gentiles to obey certain things, and they didn't have to become Jews in order to be Christians. And after that conference, Paul had determined he wanted to go on another trip, right? You remember that story, and we've talked about that. And I think Jim had even given a sermon on this, on the journeys of Paul some time back. And this time, Paul and Barnabas, I think he would have taken Barnabas, but Barnabas wanted to take John Mark. Remember, John Mark had let them down on the first journey when they got to Cyprus. he went back home, and Paul and Barnabas went up to Asia Minor. So this time, when Barnabas said, well, I still want to take Mark, he was related somehow. Paul says, no thanks, I'll take Silas, you can take Mark and go where you want to go. So they split up, and Paul and Silas then took a trip, and they revisited some of the areas where they had been. So if you can see this map from where you are, the first journey is in the blue. They went from Antioch to Perga. They went up these places, Lystra, Derbe, Iconium, Antioch, and then back to Antioch. They went through Cyprus there. And I had spoken to you before, just a speculation, that perhaps Barnabas and Mark and Paul had originally intended to go to Cyrene on the African coast, because there are a lot of Cyrenians that live there in Cyprus, and then they may have changed their mind going this way. Oh, I don't know. We don't know. It's just a guess. So that's the first trip. But then on the second trip, which they have here in purple, and if you can follow the arrows, they went up and covered the same ground. Remember, they went through the different towns, and then came up here to the edge of Turkey. It's Turkey today, or Asia Minor. And remember, Paul had he had the vision there. And, you know, they wanted to go to Asia. Says he wanted to go to Asia. He wanted to go to Bithynia. And the Holy Spirit was saying no. And finally, he has that vision of somebody in Macedonia, which is over here. It's Greece, modern-day Greece. It had somebody in Macedonia said, come here. You know, we need you to come here. So Paul and Silas end up going to Europe, you could say. They end up going up into Greece, what we call Greece today, or Macedonia at the time. I was going to read some verses. I just excuse me, on this trip, if we were in Acts 16, for instance, now, you know, what was Paul going through? Well, in Acts chapter 16, he came to Derbe and Lystra on his way up. Let's see what happened on the way up here. And what's it say here? He found Timothy there. He got Timothy in Lystra, which was good. Timothy was a very important asset to his ministry for the rest of Paul's life. And they went through the cities in verse 4 and were sharing the news of the decree that came from the apostles in Jerusalem and encouraging the churches. And when they had gone through Phrygia and Galatia, and they couldn't go into Asia. Now, that was the story so far. And then we move down to, let's say, maybe about verse 15. And this is where, you know, he ran into Lydia. Remember, when he got up to Philippi, this area, and Thessalonica, he ran into Lydia, that seller of purple that we talked about in the sermons on the life of women in Bible times. And she was well-to-do. He stayed with her. And let's see. All right, he cast a demon out of somebody, right? Here she's soothsaying and stayed there many days. But after he was tormented by this particular demon, in verse 18, he cast the demon out, and the master saw the hope of their gains were gone, and they caught Paul and Silas and drew them out into the marketplace to the rulers and brought them to the magistrates and saying, these men are troubling our city, they're teaching these customs, on and on and on. And they had laid many stripes on them, it says in verse 23, and cast them into prison. And there's a story of the prison. I won't go into that. We've talked about that before. So he was cast into prison here. So the trip, I mean, for most people, most of us, if we were took a trip somewhere and part of that trip involved going to prison and being beaten, we would say that that trip hasn't gone all that well for us so far. And I imagine if you could have cornered Paul, he would have said that, although he would have glorified in the fact that sometimes there were people hearing the message, and he does mention that from time to time in his letters. If you read all the way through to chapter 16, you find that not only did they have the jailer, but they cast them out of what other city was it? Let's see. Well, this is when they got out of prison. And they were going to beat him, and he said, that's when he said, you know, we're Romans, can't do that. Then they came to Thessalonica. In Thessalonica, he was just kicked out, cast out of the city. You know, he just had trouble. He had trouble everywhere. And in Corinthians, he writes about that. He says, you know, he's stoned here and beaten there and, you know, left for dead, and all these different things happen. So his trip wasn't going all that great in some ways. But also the Holy Spirit was drawing him to Macedonia. So this wasn't the area where most of his work was going to be. It was going to be up in here. But even here, he was running into trouble. And, you know, he hadn't made it to Corinth yet. In chapter 18, we find that there was a synagogue in his manner. He went into the synagogue and talked to them. And some of them believed, so he's excited about that. Some of them didn't believe, though. They kicked him out of that city. You know, this is what happened time after time. And then he was able to escape to Berea and went to a synagogue. And of course, there they at least listened to them and searched the scriptures to see if what they were saying were true. And, you know, he's kicked out. Then they chased him. You know, they leave one city and go to the next city and chase him out. So eventually Paul had to leave. They said, you got to leave. And he left Silas and Timothy there. And where did Paul go? Paul went to Athens. Now, they don't have Athens on this map. They don't have Athens on any of these maps for some reason. But Athens is right up here, okay? It's up in the mainland of Greece. And on his way down the coast, he stops at Athens. And this is Athens. This is supposed to be, this is Mars Hill right here. Outcrop there. And there is part of Mars Hill. That's not the hill itself, I guess. And it says that he saw the whole city given to idolatry in verse 16, and he disputed in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons in the market every day. It says he engaged people every day. And then there were certain philosophers that wanted to listen to him. And he went up to Morris Hill and had a discussion with the philosophers. And they're always wanting to learn something new, and so they were interested in what he had to say until he started talking about miracles. They didn't have much use for that. I think it says that he he got to the resurrection and said, oh, yeah, we'll talk about this later. We don't need to talk about this now. They mocked him. He says some of them mocked him because the resurrection of the dead, that didn't fit into their philosophies, not the kind of resurrection he was talking about. So anyway, he had been in Athens. Now, when you get to the end of that chapter, it says certain men, verse 34, certain men clave to him and believed, and it mentions a couple. But he spent a period of time in Athens debating in the synagogues, debating with the philosophers, talking in the marketplace to anybody who would listen, and he didn't have much to show for it. There was never, according to what we read in Acts or anywhere else in his letters, you don't read about him establishing a church in Athens. And that's like the capital, in a way, the kind of the capital of the Greek world. But no, at least of the classical Greek world. But he didn't establish a church there. So not only is he getting kicked out of these other cities, but he goes to Athens, and God doesn't bless him. He has a few people to believe and follow him along, but that's it. So is it possible that he's a little bit discouraged at this point? It's possible. By the way, we were in, we'll get to Acts, in Acts 18, and he had to leave Athens. And this is, he came to Corinth. Okay, so now he's coming down the coast, and you've got, I should go back to this map. He's coming down the coast, and he comes to this place, Corinth. And Corinth is right where the land gets real skinny. There's an isthmus there. All right, the land is very thin. You've got the mainland of Greece up here, and you've got this place called Achaia out here. And Corinth is, actually modern Corinth is on the coast. Ancient Corinth is off the coast just a little bit. But this is, 3 or 4 miles. It's not far, okay? And Corinth is a happening place for a lot of reasons. And I won't get into that now. But one of the reasons is just because of its geography. This is an important place. And advantageous for business. So let's look and see what happens when he gets to Corinth, just a little bit here. It says he found in chapter 18 in verse 2 of the book of Acts, it says he found a certain Jew named Aquila, and he had lately come from Italy because Claudius, the emperor, had kicked the Jews out of Rome. That kind of happened now and again. It didn't seem to be enforced at those times anyway. Very greatly, because they kicked people out and then they'd have to kick them out again. Well, they didn't obviously all leave if you could kick them out again. So there were different types of mild persecutions. They weren't killing them at that time, but they were telling them they had to leave. Now, it says, because he was a member of the same craft and lived with them, they worked together for by the occupation. They were tent makers. Now, at this point, it doesn't say anything about Aquila being a Christian or believing that Christ is, that Jesus is the Messiah. He's just a fellow Jew who happens to be a leather worker. Now, I mentioned last time that I spoke that there was a lot of business for tent makers or for leather workers in the Roman Empire. One of the reasons was because they happened to have the most powerful army in the world that required tents. So there was always a high demand for tent, even if that's not necessarily who Paul worked for. It kept the business afloat, right? And another reason, there are several reasons. Another reason is because in this area, I'll talk more about it later, but in this area they had something called the Isthmus Games. It was like the Olympics. Every 2 years they had these games right there in Corinth. And guess what? People came and they camped. They tend to use tents to stay there. And a tent maker, and I didn't know this before, and I won't say this with 100% certainty, but I have read, you read five people, you get five different opinions, so I don't know for sure. But one researcher said that one of the things that somebody like Paul would do if you worked in that craft is you would make sales also. And this is a place, as you can imagine, if you look at this next map, well, this is like looking at the Chesapeake Bay area in Maryland. I mean, there's going to be a lot of boats with sails around here. Because you got all these natural harbors. This is a very populated area. This is over here where Ephesus is and Smyrna, Pergamos, the seven cities in Revelation. They're all over here. A lot of people here. Italy's over here. So the trade has to go this way. And guess what? For some reason, and I'm not sure exactly what the reason is, other than that the the Mediterranean can be somewhat unpredictable. Maybe there were certain risks from theft or piracy. I don't really know. But it was worthwhile for shipping companies and you know, shippers, traders, to take their ships in here and port across the isthmus and put it in another boat here. That was cheaper or less risky than doing this, at least during certain times of the year. So back here in Corinth, you had perhaps a lot of work for tent makers or leather workers because of the sail, the industry that was required for the sails as well. But it says Aquila and Priscilla, and interestingly enough, if you go through the rest of Acts and everywhere else it's meant, not everywhere, there's one other time I think Aquila and Priscilla are mentioned. And who's mentioned? What do you read the other times? Here it says he met up with Aquila and Priscilla. What do you read almost everywhere else? Not a trick question. You read Priscilla and Aquila. The wife is mentioned first.
They taught Apollo, right?
Huh? They taught Apollo, yeah. And it mentions her first. If you look, that's up at, what verse is that? In verse 24, it says there was a certain Jew named Apollos, born in Alexandria, was an eloquent man. And remember, Alexandria is a huge city, a Greek city in Africa. It wasn't an African city. It just happened to be in Africa, but it was a Greek city. And Apollos was from there. It says this man was instructed in the way of the Lord. He was baptized by the baptism of John, so he had to be upgraded here a little bit. He hadn't got the software upgrade. And it says he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took it unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. So he had to fine tune the message here a little bit. But anyway, later on, when you read about this couple, and they seem to pop up everywhere. They're in Rome, then they're in Corinth, and then they're back in Rome. And they were very involved with Paul's ministry. And more often than not, Priscilla is mentioned first, for whatever reason. Usually it has to do with prominence and who was important in a particular task at hand. So she was one of those women who was very involved in the ministry, and including teaching people like Apollos the finer points of the law and of the fact that there was a Messiah who was Jesus and so forth, that he didn't know all of that as well as he should have. See if there's anything else I wanted to... look here. He goes to Corinth, and it says he reasoned, if we go back to verse 4, it says he reasoned every Sabbath and tried to persuade the Jews and the Greeks, because as I said in the sermon before, there were plenty of Gentiles or God-fearers associated with the synagogues. But it says, and I don't know how to read this, you read it, it says, when Silas and Timothy caught up with him, remember he left them there further north, and then they caught up with him. And it says, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ. So I don't know what he was debating with them and talking to them about before this, and to what extent he had mentioned Messiah at all. It doesn't say, and I don't know. But it said when Timothy and Silas showed up, then he starts either for the first time or in a much stronger way saying that the Messiah they were waiting for was this Jesus who was, you know, hanging on a cross and executed by the Romans. That is an offense to a lot of people, and it was an offense here. They opposed themselves and blasphemed. He shook his raiment and said to them, "Your blood be upon your own heads, and from here on I'll go to the Gentiles." So Paul, again, went to the Jews first, but they didn't receive him. So here, again, he's been preaching around the around Macedonia. He's been in prison, he's been beaten, he's been chased out of town. He took refuge in Athens and preached for a while, and nobody's listening. Nothing to show for it. And he shows up in Corinth, and goes to the synagogue like he always does, because that's where Aquila and Priscilla would have gone. And he goes there and he reasons with them. And when he starts talking about Jesus being Messiah, he gets kicked out of there, basically kicked out of there in a way. I mean, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear what he has to say. So he's discouraged, perhaps, or at least down a little bit. So when we read in 1 Corinthians that he's in a subdued state of mind. Maybe it's because of all the things he endured before he got there. But the interesting thing is, he went into this man's house, it says in verse 7, it's Justus, who was lived next to the synagogue there. So he had a way of staying in contact with the Jews, but also a place to stay. It didn't involve their hospitality. And it says, then spoke the Lord in verse 9 to Paul in the night by a vision. Don't be afraid, but speak, and don't hold your peace, for I am with you, and no man shall set on you to hurt you, for I have much people in the city. Well, that must have been a refreshing dream after all he had been through. So, okay, I can preach here, I'll be all right. But God is revealing to him that he has many people in this city. That is an amazing thing. And that, to me, it's an amazing thing. And we'll discuss why as we go on in this sermon and sermons that follow. To me, that's an amazing thing. And Paul might not have expected that because of what he knew about the city of Corinth and what I'm going to share with you. He may have his mind figured, boy, if I can't get anywhere with the Jews here, I'm just lost because I'm in, I don't know what you compare it to. I'm in New Orleans, or I'm in whatever. I'm in the Vatican. I'm trying to preach in the Vatican here. How can I expect to get anywhere? It doesn't say that he said that, but I can imagine he might have been a bit discouraged at this point. And finally gets this vision. And this vision says, go ahead, preach, because I have people in this town. You might have heard about this town, but what you haven't heard yet is that I have people here. And you got to preach to find out who they are. So I'm sure that was encouraging. And it says he continued, what's this say? He continued there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. And it mentions this Gallio, who was the governor. And there's speculation. Gallio, there were people that complained about Paul, and he said, leave him alone. He's not hurting anything. And the governors were replaced in this area anywhere. They were replaced generally every year. So there's speculation that Paul left about the time that guy left. We don't know. But he stayed for a year, at least a year and a half there in Corinth and preached. Okay, see if anything else I want to cover here. There's things I have in my notes twice, and I think I'm going to skip some of it this time and come back to it later. Now, if we go on, he finally leaves, and in verse 20, it says he came to Ephesus, or verse 19, they stayed there and went to the synagogue, and they wanted him to stay longer, and he said, no, I have to go. So, I don't think I put it in here again. No, I didn't. But if I go back to this map. So he goes, got a lot of them at home. After he goes to Corinth, he goes back to Ephesus, but he doesn't stay. And then he hightails it back home. So 1 Corinthians is written from Ephesus. And the question is, when did he write it? Well, he wasn't there very long this time. But he takes another journey. On this map, it's the red one. And when he takes the red one, he stays in Ephesus for 2 or 3 years. And so it makes sense that while he's on his third journey and he's spending all this time, over 2 years in Ephesus, that that's when he wrote the letter 1 Corinthians. And he wrote several letters to the Corinthians. We have two of them. There may be as many as four. Okay. By the way, this you can't see it. It's probably in yellow there. Achaia. It talks about the region of Achaia. That's this area. Once you cross the isthmus, you're in this whole area is called Achaia. So that's the region around Corinth. Well, why did he have a lot of people in Corinth? Well, I don't know the answer to that. But one thing you can say that we can know is it's a good place. I mean, it's at a crossroads. It's at a shipping crossroads, trading crossroads. There are people from all over there. Now, there's a little bit of history about Corinth. I'll mention some of that later. I think I'll skip it right now. Now, it's customarily believed and taught. You read most commentaries on 1 Corinthians. They give you the impression, and the belief is, that Paul got this communication from Corinth, and he had to answer it. So you know, he's in Ephesus. He can't come right now, but he's going to write it. He fires off a letter and kind of writes it quickly, or has it written. You know, he has a scribe. Because he writes real big. He says, I wrote with my own hands big letters. So whether he couldn't write a whole thing or if it would just take too much papyrus, it cost too much money or whatever, he usually had a scribe that would write it for him. But he writes it from Ephesus. And the impression you get from reading the commentaries is that he's got these things he's got to deal with. It's a mess, and he just fires this letter off. He's going to give one idea after the other. Not really very organized, not very, you know, not that he's saying things that are wrong or incorrect, but it's just kind of cobbled together as the thoughts come to him. Almost like a stream of consciousness kind of a thing. That's the way it comes across when you read the commentaries. I would say that's the way I was taught, or what I believe, that Paul gets this letter and he has to answer the letter. So he just fires off an answer real quick, dealing with what he can until he gets there. And that it's rather haphazard, maybe not all that organized. Based on research by Kenneth Bailey, and I have preached things that I've learned from this man before, I want to challenge that assumption. Kenneth Bailey spent most of his career, he lives near Pittsburgh now, he's retired, I guess, but he spent most of his career in Syria and Palestine and different Egypt and different places, teaching at seminaries in the Middle East. And when I have given sermons on the parables, I have used this man as a resource because he has an understanding, not that he's so special necessarily, but he's lived there. He knows the Middle Eastern mind, and he knows the Western mind that we have, and he's, through his writings, I've been able to bridge the gap a little bit between my brain and a brain that lives in the Middle East. He's very helpful that way. Another way that he's been helpful, and this is where it comes into play in this particular couple of sermons I'm going to give, or however many it is that Kenneth Bailey has noticed the structure of the Old Testament prophets and also the Psalms, the Hebrew poetic structure of those writings, and he's been able to, or just because his mind's on it, I guess, he looks at Scripture in the New Testament, and he sees the same structure. And I've shared that with you with the parables. And this whole book, which I've just read over the last month or so, or since the last time I spoke, last 2-3 weeks, this whole book is just about 1 Corinthians and about the structure of 1 Corinthians. So sharing what I have learned from him, not all of it, but I'll try to share a little bit of it, enough that it helps us to understand. I want to challenge this point of view that 1 Corinthians is kind of an off-the-cuff reply to a letter and offer an alternative. And that alternative is that there is a tremendous amount of structure and organization to the book of 1 Corinthians, to the letter of 1 Corinthians. That it was very carefully thought out, not that he wouldn't have carefully thought out a letter, but that he organized it in such a way and took a long time to do it. Not only that, Paul was obviously trained. It says he was trained at the feet of Gamaliel? Paul was taught in the Jewish letters, okay? So he understood the way the prophets were written. So it wasn't something foreign to him. It might be foreign to us, but it wasn't foreign to him. So I make a case here that this letter is highly organized, carefully structured, and also that it was intended to be read by the entire church, not just the people in Corinth. Actually, I don't have to make that case. It's just Paul says it right in the letter. But I think we've overlooked that. So the letter is an important message for the church at that time, as well as for the church at this time. And maybe we'll be surprised at all the similarities. But first, let's go back to Corinth. And I don't know how much further I'll get than just talking about Corinth today. I mentioned that you've got this isthmus here. Even as far back as in classical Greek, they talked of Greece, in B.C., they talked about building a canal here. But there wasn't a canal in the time of Paul. Nero was talking about it as well. That's during and after Paul's time. Nero is probably the reason why Paul was killed. But they talked about putting a canal there. There is one there now. But what happened is because of all the trade that you had that wanted to go from here to here or vice versa, or perhaps even trade that was destined for this area, but it didn't take everything that was on the ship, and then you wanted to take some of it even further, there was a market or a market for slaves and other laborers to carry goods across the isthmus, and it was a thriving business. And if the boat was small enough, they had mechanisms for getting the boats. You could port the boat itself, you know, rolling on logs or whatever they did. I don't know. But it was a little over 3 miles at the time. Now, ancient Corinth was down here. The modern city is right on the coast. I mentioned that they had the Isthmus Games. This was a big deal. It was such a big deal that back in classical Greece, back when the different Greek city-states were fighting each other and having wars pretty regularly, before Philip, Alexander's father, kind of unified them all, and then they went conquering other people. Before that, they basically tried to conquer each other. You had Sparta, you had Athens, you had Corinth, which was kind of in the middle, and sometimes usually sided with Sparta. But what's interesting is that when it was time for the games, guess what? They had a truce. Even if they're fighting Athens, when it's time for the games, the Athenian athletes could come for the games. So it's kind of a different kind of environment, you know. Yeah, we're fighting, but it's time for the games. Come on. You know? So they'd have a truce. So the games were a big deal, and they were a big deal on into into the world of at the time of Paul as well. This is, I don't know if you can read this. Can you read down there at all? It says, there's an I-S-T-H. Actually, it almost looks like it's in English. But it's a coin that's minted to celebrate the Isthmus Games. So we have archaeological evidence besides the literary evidence. Corinth was also known, the old Corinth, and I haven't told you about that yet, but the old Corinth was also known for having a special kind of brass or bronze. And I don't understand this. I haven't done a lot of research on it. I just kind of tried to look it up. It's like they know that this existed because it's in the literary, they have the evidence from the literary sources, but they don't have any of this brass or bronze. It's supposed to be something special, but nobody knows what it is because they haven't discovered any of it. They just read about it. So I don't know what it is, but suffice it to say, and I was going to get Brad to hook me up to the sound, but I really couldn't get a good enough video to do it. I thought about bringing a pot and I didn't, but Kenneth Bailey talks about Aleppo, Syria. Now, Aleppo now, the marketplace has been destroyed because of the ISIS fighting and the wars, the battles in Syria here over the last 3-4 years. But before that, they had a thriving marketplace there in Aleppo. And one of the features of this market was they were known for their coppersmiths and their brasssmiths and all this. And there was a certain district, as you can imagine. You ever heard anybody banging on a pot? Can you imagine like 50 people doing that on this long alley? You can't hear yourself think. And that's what Bailey says. Bailey says when he visited Aleppo, he said you had to shout right in somebody's ear to have a conversation. If you want to talk to one of those, because the rest of them are going to stop banging on their pots or whatever they're making. So you got to shout. You got to get right up to somebody and shout at them in order to be heard. Well, this is the kind of market that they also had in Corinth in the old days. When I say the old days, what I haven't told you, and you may know this, is that when the Romans were expanding their empire in the times before Julius Caesar, the time of the Roman Republic, all right, when they would send generals out at their own expense who just happened to be senators and they'd raise an army and whatever. When they came to Corinth, Corinth said, no, thank you, we don't want to be part of your whatever they called it, part of your republic. And I forget the general's name, but he basically leveled the city. It was 146 B.C., destroyed the city, killed all the men, put the women and children into slavery, just, you know, no love lost there. So Corinth ceased to be around 146 B.C., and for 100 years, it was not. And then Julius Caesar, around 44, I also saw 46 as a date, I don't know, but most of the sources said 44 B.C., Julius Caesar refounded Corinth, and he populated it with freedmen, people who had been slaves or perhaps had been in the army. A lot of these freedmen were former former soldiers, and you give them their citizenship and you put them in the city. So Corinth at the time of Paul, although it was in Macedonia or Achaia, if you want to call it that, it was more of a Roman city than the surrounding cities because it had been rebuilt by and kind of refounded, you might say, by Julius Caesar and populated by Romans, not by Greeks, by the typical Greeks. Not that there weren't Greeks there, not that there weren't plenty of Jews there. Of course, there were lots of people there. It was very cosmopolitan. But it was a Roman city. More than, you know, like I told you before, Alexandria was a Greek city, but it's in Africa. Well, here you had a Roman city in Greece. But it really was a Roman city. If you look in the Bible, you look at other sources, people's names in Corinth are not, they're not Greek. There's some Greek names, but there's a lot of Latin names. These are Romans that live in Corinth. So by the time Paul gets there, in whatever it is, in the late 40s or 50 AD or whatever, he's looking around a town. It must be a pretty nice town. There's nothing that's over 100 years old. It's all new. It's all new. It's kind of nice. Funded at government expense, built by the Romans, right? Built by the government. Here's a satellite picture. Now there's a canal. All right? They got a canal there now. Here's the modern city of Corinth. The old city of Corinth was down here. And there's a mountain there. Has a name. I can't remember the name. Oh, there you go. There's the... That doesn't even look like a real picture, but it is. It might be out of proportion, but it... They have a couple of bridges over top of this thing, and but they never were able to use it commercially. This canal was finished somewhere close to 1900, 1895 maybe, or something like that. It took that long. You know, the classical Greeks had the idea, Nero had the idea, but it never got built until the 19th century. And it's too small to use for much commercial shipping. It's mostly just tourists. You see it advertised. This is an advertisement from a tourism company. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? I mean, look where sea level is. So those slaves that had to haul the produce or whatever it was, all the stuff out of the boats and take it to the other harbor, they had a climb. They had a climb. It was only 3 miles. They had to go at least that high. So that had to be some work. I just put a couple of pictures in here just to give you an idea that the Romans were no slouches when it came to building stuff. And, you know, if you were at parts of the old city, this is the view. This is kind of the view from the amphitheater. Look at that. You know, if you were called to a town meeting, you know, in your town, there's a name for those people, I forget. I didn't look it up between the last sermon and now. But the town officers call a meeting, you know, and they're loyal to Rome. I mean, everybody's loyal to Rome, right? And they built this amphitheater, and you go in there, and this is the view you have. You can kind of feel like you're on top of the world, can't you? You know, what could be greater than Rome? I can see it. This isn't the only picture like this. In other towns, it's the same thing. They're beautiful, beautiful pictures that project power. You know, we're tame the landscape, build this thing here. Have our meetings here. Have our plays here. Have our concerts here. It's impressive, isn't it? It's beautiful. This is what the downtown of the old city looked like, what they've been able to put together. And I've just put this in here just to mostly really to tie back into the last sermon I gave. If you were in the diaspora and you're a Jew, remember we talked about the difficulty of just the way you have to interact with people that don't believe the same thing and don't practice the same thing, and all the meat is, you know, is pretty much all the meat sacrificed in a temple somewhere. Well, here's the market. Here's the downtown market. Well, what do you have near the downtown market? Well, you got the Temple of Octavia. You got the, by the way, took Patty to, she's in Tunisia. Our waitress was Octavia. I said, who in the world's Octavia? We didn't take her to Tunisia. We took her to the airport. She's in Tunisia. But our waitress was Octavia. So you got the Temple of Octavia. You got the Temple of Apollos, or Apollo. And they're right next to the market. Is there a reason for that? Absolutely, because that's where the meat comes from. So it's a very real, just looking at this, you get an idea of the reality of the things that a Jew or a Christian had to deal with in the first century. And whether it mattered or not, which of course Paul deals with. But this is the downtown where all the public buildings are. You've got you've got a basilica, you've got the theater, not the amphitheater that's up on the hill, but you've got a theater down there, and you got other things, an Odia playhouse. But you got a great big market. So I assume that, at least in the old city, that's where the copper bangers were, or the brass bangers, whoever they were. There's a very important temple that's not in this picture. Anybody know what the important temple in Corinth was? It was up on that hill. The temple of Aphrodite. And this temple and all that was associated with it is what gave, is one of the things that gave Corinth its reputation. So here you have the temple of Apollo in town. There were 38 pillars. There's seven of them that are still columns that are still up. But there were 38 around this temple. And up there, somewhere, supposed to be on top. I didn't see any pictures of it, though, to give you, but that was where the temple of Aphrodite was. Now, Corinth was well known for this temple and all that was associated with it. And one of the things that was associated with this temple, as well as most temples in that world, but especially this one, because Aphrodite was the goddess of love, were the temple prostitutes. Around, I think it's before the time of Paul, one of the historians writes that there were 1,000 temple prostitutes associated with the temple. Now, you know these things about Corinth, it starts to shed some light, and that's the reason I'm sharing it, shed some light on some of the things that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians. That it was settled by a lot of ex-soldiers who were given their, when they got retired, they were given their citizenship and a place to settle. Paul likes to use military analogies sometimes. Some of the words he uses is hidden in English, you don't see it. But the Greek words are words like when he talks in the resurrection chapter about everyone being resurrected in their own order, that word is, the Greek word for order is the word for rank, where you are in your ranks in an army. So he uses a military term. Why? Well, maybe because this is part of the culture there. He uses athletic terms. Why? Well, they have the games there every 2 years. It's very important. And of course, one of the big problems that he has to deal with is the problem of the morality of the new Christians. And one of the reasons is because of this. This was a center. This was the, not that there weren't other temples to Aphrodite, but this was the temple. This was her center. Just like Diana's temple was Ephesus. You know, the main place. Well, this was this was Aphrodite's place. And it was well known over the whole world. In fact, there was a saying that not everybody gets to go to Corinth. Not everyone gets to go to Corinth. It was kind of up there. Well, you know, not everybody makes it. Not everybody worthy. Not whatever it would be. And we can read that in the ancient literature. There's this big brass market. And Paul talks about if you have the gifts of the Spirit and you don't have love, you're like a clanging cymbal. You know, you're like the noise in the market, is what he's saying. That all that bang, 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 bang. This was something that was familiar to them. This was probably the second largest Roman city. Now, there were other big cities in the Roman Empire, but probably the second largest Roman city. In the times before it was destroyed, in 146, it was supposed to have, in like 400 BC, it was supposed to have about 90,000 people. There are lots of estimates for afterwards, anywhere from 100 to 700,000 people, so who knows, but it was a big city. It was a very worldly city. Now, when I talk about 100 or talk about 1,000 temple prostitutes, it was a weird society. And Rome was a weird society, but Corinth even more so. There were very strict laws. This may seem foreign to us. There were very strict laws against adultery. Okay? Adultery means, to them, you know, I guess another married woman or another married man and you're married or whatever, that kind of a thing. Which adultery means technically, I guess, to us too. But prostitution and the use of prostitutes was just normal everyday life, and that was totally accepted. And you know, whether you were married or not married, didn't matter. That was okay. It was accept it. It was legal. Why is it legal? Nothing's changed. Why do governments legalize things? So they can tax it. That's how we know some about what we know about prostitution in this era, because there was in the tax records. They had to pay taxes. Prostitutes had to pay taxes on their income. But it was legal. And not just legal, it was encouraged. This was the place you went. And of course, you had all these travelers, right? But it was normal. It was expected. It was legal. So when you, again, get into 1 Corinthians, why is Paul going into such detail? These are church people. Don't they understand? No, they don't. Because their culture, this is normal. They're Gentiles. They're not Jews. They grew up in a culture that where this was normal behavior. And Paul's saying, well, this isn't normal. This isn't acceptable. And he has to go to great lengths, and we'll get into that later. Not later today, but later on. We'll get into how he goes about explaining it, because he doesn't just say it's wrong. He goes into reasons why, because he's got a cosmopolitan town. It'd be like going to New York trying to explain something there. Because, yeah, sure, yeah, you need an explanation, right? You need some reason. You can't just say it, and you can't do that in Corinth either. Paul doesn't just say, it's because I said so. He goes into long, complicated explanations and arguments, if you want to put it that way, or defenses of his positions. And the reason he has to do that is because he's dealing with something that's an extremely different culture from the culture that he grew up in Tarsus, the culture that he was trained in Jerusalem under Gamaliel. It's just entirely different. And he's smart enough, Paul's no dummy, he's smart enough to know how he needs to go about explaining this. And when you get into the structure and the way that 1 Corinthians is put together, you see what he did and how he did it. And to me, this was amazing. That's why I want to share it with you. But I have to give you this background to know even just where Paul's coming from and why. Why he has to do it. Okay. So after spending time there, establishing a congregation that's primarily Gentile, Paul has occasion to write them. And then in 1 Corinthians, so I told you we'd go back there. I think it's important to notice, and I noticed it before, but I just didn't realize how significant it was. In the very beginning, it says, Paul, called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God, and Sosthenes, our brother, I'll probably talk about him later, unto the church of God which is at Corinth, unto them which are sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints or called saints, with all that in every place call upon the name of Jesus Christ our Lord, both theirs and ours, you know, their Lord and our Lord. So Paul is addressing this letter to the Christians in Corinth and all the other people that claim the name of Christ, all the other Christians. Right in the beginning, he says, this is not just, so if you have in your mind, which I had in my mind, that this is an answer to specific questions in a letter, and that's the purpose of this, the whole thing, I want you to consider, anyway, getting rid of that approach, because I think it's not correct. Is he addressing things that were in their letter? Yes, some of it. But he's addressing things that weren't in the letter. You go through 1 Corinthians, it says, oh, I heard from... Well, he doesn't always say who he heard from. Sometimes he doesn't identify them because they don't want to get in trouble. You know, I hear that this is going on. I hear that some of you are saying that. He addresses things that they didn't write to him about. Probably things that they wish he didn't know. It doesn't say, he doesn't say, well, you wrote me about this guy that's living with his stepmother. He heard about that. They did write him about some things. But some things they didn't write him about. He heard about it. But it's significant what he says. He wants the whole church to read this. So it's not just a shoot from the hip answer to some questions that he got in a letter. It's a carefully thought out, well planned, well organized letter that he intends to be read in all the churches where it can be delivered. And he does that for a reason. And as you go through it, I think you'll see what it is. It's because the things he's dealing with and the way he deals with it, or them, the way he deals with those things, are just what these new Christian churches need, especially considering where they came from and the cultures that they represent, that needed a new approach. You can't just, not that he didn't, you know, mention the prophets, not that he didn't mention the Torah. Sure he does. But it needed more than that, because these people didn't come from that culture. They weren't largely Jewish. They hadn't been associated with the synagogue in many cases. So he needed something else. And he had plenty of experience. And he had plenty of time to think about it. He was, you know, he's in Ephesus making tents for 2 or 3 years. He had plenty of time to think about it and plenty of time to work on it. It says, if you probably didn't save your place in Acts. If I can find it. This is in, where is he now? Sorry. This is in Ephesus. Continued by the space of 2 years, so that, okay. This is what it says, and there were some that didn't believe, but spoke evil of the way before the multitude. He left them and separated the disciples, disputing daily in the school of one Tyrannus. That's Acts 19 and verse 9. It says for 2 years he made his points in this school. You know, somebody had some kind of a venue for discussing ideas and so forth. And he talked about it every day for 2 years. It talks about he was in the desert for 3 years. You know, he had a lot of time to think about things, to think about his theology, to think about what he had learned as a Pharisee, how that applied, how it didn't apply, how things had to change, when he started preaching to the Gentiles, how this is going to be different. He had a lot of time to hone his arguments and to practice them every day for 2 years here. So when it came time that he had to write this letter to the Corinthians, he didn't have to shoot from the hip. He had a lot of practice already. And he had thought about these things long and hard. And he had the answers. And he had the approaches. And that's what he shares in 1 Corinthians. In, you know, we read in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1, and this is where we get it from. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote to me. Okay, so he's saying, okay, I got your letter. I'll deal with your questions. Some of them. And he does deal with some of them. But he deals with a lot of other things. Some of the things they hadn't written to him about, some of the things he heard about, and he was disappointed to hear. The amazing thing, and I just won't get into it today, but as a studied 1 Corinthians, and you've probably done the same thing, and you read what they were dealing with, what Paul was dealing with, what was going on in the church, and Paul says, these are my brothers, these are my sisters, these are Christians. You know, I'm not saying what we should or shouldn't do as individual congregations, but, you know, we come from a culture where we just put people out on their heads because they don't believe the same thing about this or that we do. Boy, would that Paul had those kind of problems in Corinth. He wasn't dealing with that kind of stuff. He was dealing with what we would consider serious moral problems. But he understood these people had the Spirit of God. They had the gifts of the Spirit. So they were converted. They were his brothers and sisters. But they had serious problems, serious moral feelings, because they came from a culture where what Paul saw as a moral feeling and what God sees as a moral feeling wasn't a moral feeling. It was just normal, everyday behavior. What a challenge that must have been. What a challenge it would have been for me to be in that church environment. Now, y'all didn't know me when I was younger, most of you, but you think I'm bad now, you should have known me then. You know, just in terms of, you know, wanting things to be just so, you know, down the line. That's the way I was brought up. I don't know if Paul was brought up that way or not, but if he was, he had to get out of it real quick once he got into Corinth. You read 1 Corinthians, and these are his brothers and sisters, and he loves them, and he corrects them, but they're his brothers and sisters. It's amazing. And it's so important that he decides he wants to write this in such a way that it'll make sense to everybody in all of his churches. and he wants it to be spread around to the other churches as well. It's not just specifically to the Corinthians. So what kind of structure is it? Let's just look at it briefly to end the sermon. We won't go into 1 Corinthians, but I've covered some of this before, just a reminder, and we will look at these things in the future as well. All right, you got the whole thing here. I should have animated it. But the structure determines the punchline, the main point. If I say a lady who lives in Enola, sorry, Arlene, a lady who lives in Enola once met the late Ayatollah. Is it true, she inquired, that Allah gets tired? Why, yes, that's why he drinks cola. Okay, I made up a limerick. Everybody knows that the first two lines of the limerick are identifying the people that are involved. Everybody knows that the next two lines of the limerick give you the situation. They set up the joke, and everybody knows the last line of a limerick is the punchline. Why do we know that? Because that's the way limericks are. Every limerick you've ever heard is like that. Because that's a style of writing. And we know that, and we're comfortable with that, and we're just familiar with that. As I pointed out to you before, in the Old Testament, we have a lot of that. They're not limericks. They're other things. Kenneth Bailey calls them prophetic templates. He has different names for them. Seek you the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his ways and the righteous man his thoughts. And let him return to the Lord, and he will have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Does that look like a poem to you? It is. Standard parallelism. Very common in Hebrew scriptures, yes.
What scripture was that?
Isaiah 55, verses 6 and 7. It's standard parallelism. The first line is connected to the second line. Third line to the fourth. Fifth to the sixth. That's easy. That's, you see that a lot. It's all over the Old Testament. So when Paul, sitting at the feet of Gamaliel, learning about the Torah, learning about the prophets, learning about the writings, he's learning about all this stuff. He knows. He knows how to read it. He recognizes it. It's part of his culture. He knows what it means. He knows how it's written and where the punchline is, where the main ideas are. And that's what's so enlightening in 1 Corinthians to me. Once you realize the structure, then you know where the main point is. And yeah, it's a whole lot of ideas. It's a whole lot of different things in there. But the main point is always in a certain place. And then you see where Paul's coming from in a way that maybe you didn't see before. It doesn't take away from the other thing, everything else he says, but when you have a structure, it lets you know what he's emphasizing in a way that you wouldn't know otherwise. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, the next few verses. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are my ways your ways my ways. For as heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. This is an inverted parallelism. It goes A, B, C, B, A. All right? It goes like this, that way, and then back. And the main point is in the middle. And so there's different ways of putting the main point in the middle. In this case, it's a parable or a simile. You know, for as the heavens are higher than the earth. That's very common. You will see that in Corinthians several times. Where you get to the middle of it, it's for as this, or it's some kind of a metaphor or a simile or a parable. It's in there a bunch of times. This just really amazed me when I saw it. This particular one is a chiasm. We talked about that before. That's not important for Corinthians. Here's another step parallelism. A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D. This rain is so come down from heaven. My word does that. It doesn't return empty. It doesn't return empty. So, you know, this one associates with that one. This one associates it with that one. And so forth. That's another Hebrew poetic style. You don't see this exactly in Corinthians. Now, here's the... I think it's the last two. Here we go. Sorry. Here's another one. Notice, this is just setting it up right here. We have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made a pact. Your covenant with death will be canceled, and your pact with Sheol will not stand. Is there a connection? Yes. You see that, how it goes this way and comes back? All right, this is Isaiah 28. This happens in Isaiah a lot. It happens in the Old Testament a lot. The overwhelming scourge, that's the second line. Well, that would be associated with the hail and the refuge of lies in the water. Oh, wait a minute, here, I guess that was combined. Falsehood is our refuge and concealed ourselves. Here we got the refuge here. The cornerstone, firmly placed. And here it talks about righteousness being level and a measuring line. So these two lines are connected. And then he who believes in it will not be disturbed. That's the most important thing. You believe in Messiah, you'll be okay. That's the punchline right in the middle. But what you find when we go through Corinthians is that it's written so skillfully that sometimes if you just take out the middle, and if you think it went from here down straight to here, you can't tell that anything's missing. It's amazing. We'll see it. It's structured in such a way that if you take out these three, this line goes with this line. It seems like it came right after it. It's a skill. It's a skill. And Paul was not only aware of the skill, he knew how to use it, and he did. And he didn't just fire this letter off as a response. He couldn't have. When you see how complex and structured it is, I think you'll be convinced. I can't tell you that you have to be convinced, but I think you'll be convinced, as I am, that it took a lot of work to produce this. Here's one we all know. He was despised and rejected of men, or forsaken of men. Man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face. He was despised and we did not esteem him. There you have a parable or a simile. And like one. It's like this. That's what's in the middle. That's very common. Again, we'll see it in Corinthians, where you get to the middle, the main point, and he makes the point by a parable or a story of some sort. Grief here, grief there, see? Sorrows and grief. Afflicted, despised, forsaken, stricken and smitten of God. Now, these are the ones, I can't expect you to read this down where you are, but it illustrates two other things, that two other styles, well, one other style and one is a combination. This is, to quote Kenneth Bailey, he calls it a high jump. And the reason he calls it a high jump is because the main structure is right here, okay? All right, that's the structure. You got Jacob, my servant, and Jacob, my servant down here. You've got water on thirsty land, stream on dry grounds. You have springing up of grass like poplars by streams, and pouring out the Spirit in the middle, the important thing. So here's the structure. But he calls it a high jump, and I have to cover this because it's very common in 1 Corinthians, because yeah, all right, here's where you go up to the bar. Here's where you're crossing the bar. This is his analogy. And here's where you come down on the other side. But this is the run up to. This is the run. Here's the run. Here's the ascent. Here you go over the bar. Here you come back down onto the mat. Follow that? High jump style. It's set up. There's a little bit of setup before you actually approach the high bar. So that's why he likes to call it the high jump style. Here's another one, Isaiah 56. Again, I don't expect you to be able to read this, but it sets up here, and then you have this style. It talks about the Sabbath. It's got the Sabbath in the middle. It's got the Sabbath at the end. It talks about the foreigner, but the foreigner, again, you come down here, foreigners. You have eunuchs. Here it doesn't mention eunuchs, but it talks about having a name that won't be cut off, because eunuchs can't have anybody to, their progeny. So it's to the eunuch. So here, the style was there, and the style was all throughout 1 Corinthians. So you'll see this again and again in 1 Corinthians. That's why I'm convinced with Bailey. I didn't come up with this. I just read the book. But I'm convinced, as he is, that Paul put a lot of thought, a lot of effort, and a lot of work and time into putting structure into 1 Corinthians. And when you know the structure, you know what's in the middle. What were his main points? Why they're there? And I don't know how many, I might just do a sermon or two. I don't know how many I'll do. Definitely, I'm speaking next week. I will at least get into it, and we'll take a look. We'll get into 1 Corinthians, and we'll see how these Old Testament Hebrew forms of poetry and of making the point are used by Paul in the New Testament, writing in Greek. They're used to amazing effectiveness. So that's what we'd like to have to look forward to next time.